Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, tomorrow is Valentine's Day, one day at least that we set aside to talk about love and to display our affection for the significant others in our life. So we thought wouldn't be such a bad time to talk a little bit about love and about what science can tell us about the nature of love, what it is, why it is that human beings bond with one another. And we'll be talking this morning with one of the authors of a book that looks at some of this research. The book is titled A General Theory of Love, and it's published in Paper by Vintage. And our guest is Dr. Thomas Lewis. He's an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California at San Francisco School of Medicine. He's also former associate director of the Affective Disorders Program there. He now divides his time between writing, a private practice, and teaching at the med school there, University of California, San Francisco. And he's talking with us by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means it would be a long-distance call. Use that number, and we'll pay for it, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Lewis, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It seems interesting, just right from the beginning, that one might have to say that you would wonder, given the fact that love is something that's difficult to define, it's difficult to even talk about, to put into words. People have been trying for a long, long time to find exactly the right words to do that. And one would think that an enterprise like science, which really is interested in things that you can measure and that you can hold in your hand, just wouldn't be amenable to looking at a question like, what is love?
Well, I think you you certainly would think that at first blush, and in some ways it's surprising that science has anything at all to say about something as seemingly intangible as love. But as science gets better at cracking some of the mysteries of the brain, many of our mental processes become amenable to scientific discovery, so that we have a better understanding of how speech works, of how our motor system works, of how vision works. And so on that level, it may not be surprising that science has a better idea of how feelings work and how love works than we used to, because those also come out of the brain. And the better we understand the brain, the better we can potentially understand those phenomena as well.
It certainly seems that emotional experience, various kinds of emotional experience, are very nearly universal. That is, all people seem to experience emotions and sort of the same kind of emotions. And we understand that in other people. If you, for example, cite the kind of research that says if you take photographs, if you take a picture of someone who is clearly happy and a picture of someone who is clearly in distress and clearly sad, you can go around the world and show those pictures to people of different cultures. And if you ask them to describe what that person is experiencing, there's no question that people, just by looking at the facial expression of the other, they know that one person's happy and one person, you know, something really bad, something very sad and distressing has happened to that other person. So it seems that there is indeed something going on that cuts across cultural differences, everything else, and that we all experience these things.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, the first person to suppose that was Charles Darwin. And Darwin, of course, the father of the theory of evolution, was convinced that emotions and emotional experience also comes from our evolutionary past. And he was convinced that because of that, emotions should be the same cross-culturally in all human beings, just as, for instance, the structure of the wrist or the knee is the same cross-culturally in all human beings. And he was correct, actually, in the research that you described there. It certainly proves that that's true, that as far as we know, human beings everywhere on the surface of the planet have the same emotions, they have the same emotional expressions, and we can all recognize the emotional expressions of other people effortlessly. So we're born with that innate kind of communication system that allows us to interpret behavior and communicate with people when we don't share a verbal or spoken language with them.
Hmm. And do we explain this by saying that being able to understand another person's emotional state is just it's something that is very important if we think that it's important for people to kind of hang together in groups and for people to feel that I have a stake in the survival of the other person, that then having some understanding of another person's experience is important for them?
Well, that's quite true, that animals of all sorts are designed so that they have specialized sensory systems in their brain to process just the kinds of information that are most important for their survival, so that snakes, for instance, can see into the infrared part of the spectrum, which allows them to spot rats or mice that are hidden in the grass. Bats, of course, use the echolocation of their sonar systems to navigate in the dark. And our brains also have a very specialized sensory system that enables our survival, and that includes the ability to sense emotions. And there are vast portions of the brain that are dedicated just towards processing facial expressions, being able to look at another person's face and analyze the contractions of muscles and the position of the head and the pupillary dilatation, and to interpret that information and make sense of it and understand effortlessly, just in a millisecond, what is going on inside another person. Is that person angry or wistful or sad or happy or joyous? And that turns out to be vital to our survival for some surprising reasons. Not only that it helps us get along, but because that kind of emotional communication, for better or worse, turns out to be a basic survival ingredient for human beings. If you take that away from people, their bodies don't function very well, and in some cases, it actually kills them.
It's interesting. I just last week talked with a psychologist, a developmental psychologist named Alison Gopnik, was here to talk about some of her work. And one of the things that she talked about was babies' abilities to mimic facial expressions and the fact that it's something that they seem to be hardwired for. That is, within an hour after the time they're born, they are able to repeat, reflect. One of the classic experiments was that with this newborn, if you stick out your tongue at the baby will stick out his or her tongue back.
Right.
And you have to think that ability is simply something that we are born with, and that it's part of this business of establishing the bond with the adult caretaker, which, as far as the baby's concerned, is pretty important.
It's absolutely vital, and you're quite right. It's interesting to note that there are so many things that babies can't do that seem very important to survival. They can't feed themselves. They can't walk or run away if danger looms. But the thing that they can do, and which they are highly predisposed to do, is to look other people in the eye and in the face and study faces and interact with other people emotionally. And to a surprising extent, this turns out to be actually as physiologically vital to a baby's survival as food or water. And in several experiments that have been performed by historical accident, not by design, it's been clearly demonstrated that if you take human infants and you give them food and water and clothing and physical warmth, but you deny them emotional communication with other human beings, that almost all of those infants die, because emotional nurturance and contact actually is as vital to an infant's survival as food or water is.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting that these studies have sort of not intentional studies in a way, but some rather famous studies have looked at orphanages, for example, big places where they were taking care of babies, and maybe for whatever reason they didn't have enough staff, they didn't want to transmit disease, they were taking care of all the kids' physical needs, they were feeding them, they were keeping them warm, they were keeping them clean, they were changing their diapers, but that was about all. No one picked up the baby, no one cooed to them, there wasn't a lot of physical contact, all the things that we hope parents will do, and even though the basic physical needs were taken care of, the children withered.
Absolutely, and as you mentioned, this was most prominently conducted on an unknowing basis in the early part of the century, when doctors were very impressed by the germ theory of disease, and they felt that orphaned infants and young children would be much better off if people didn't breathe on them and didn't touch them, and so they were sequestered away in these nurseries where they were cared for in terms of food and water, but they were not held or picked up or spoken to or played with. And the mortality rates were appalling, actually, in those nurseries, between 75% and 100% of the infants subjected to those conditions simply withered away and died. They succumbed to infection, or they simply didn't gain weight even though they were fed, and just kind of withered right out of existence.
We're talking, I should introduce again our guest, and we have a caller we'll get to, and we'll continue to talk about the book, A General Theory of Love, looking at some of the scientific research that has been done, trying to look at answering the question, what is love all about? Why is it that human beings experience it? Why is it some people seem not to have much luck finding it? And why is it that when we're apart from the people that are important to us, it may indeed feel physically painful? Our guest is Dr. Thomas Lewis. He is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and is one of the authors of this book, which is available in paper and published by Vintage. We have a caller in Urbana to talk with. We'll do that right now on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
As I was listening, it somehow came to my mind to think about what's the relationship between empathy and love.
Well, that's a very interesting question. Empathy actually probably is almost synonymous with that sensory capacity that we were talking about earlier, with the capacity to discern what's going on inside somebody else. It's different from sympathy, which is the ability to feel sorry for somebody based on your ability to discern what's going on inside them. But empathy really is the kind of emotional analog of vision. That I can look out with my eyes and I can see the landscape. With empathy, I can look into another person and experience what's going on for that person, which may be quite different than what's going on for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking of it, too, because I have read about one of the problems with criminals often is that some of them apparently aren't able to experience empathy.
That's a fascinating question, and you're absolutely right. A fascinating observation that one of the fundamental things that appears to be wrong with sociopathic criminals is that they are insensitive to emotional communication. They're in a sense blind to the emotional dimension or empathy, so that they don't feel another person's pain. It doesn't mean anything to them any more than color, you know, means much to a blind person. So that they're easily able to whack somebody over on the head or to shoot them or to murder their children. And it doesn't bother them because they don't discern any of the emotional distress from the other person. It doesn't register. It doesn't mean anything.
And so the next question is, in the development area of children, what the implications are for that, and whether development can be influenced in that way, or whether there's just something missing in those people. So,
well, development in children certainly can be tremendously influenced by their emotional environment, and we know now that one of the things that relationships do is regulate our physiology. It's when two people are in a relationship, they're regulating each other's body in important ways, each other's immune system, heart rate, and so forth. One of the things that happens to children when they're in a relationship is that their brain development is regulated. So that's one of the things that children get out of a relationship with parents, is that it's actually necessary for the proper development of the brain. And children who are subjected to emotional deprivation often do not develop normally in terms of their brain function. And one of the functions they don't develop is that empathic function.
Uh-huh.
So that, for instance, you may have heard of the children in Romanian orphanages in the 1990s, where they were warehoused in situations that were similar in terms of emotional deprivation, that they got food and water and clothing, but very little interaction with adults. Even when those children were adopted into loving families, some of those children actually can't be rescued from that state of emotional deprivation, that they again appear to be empathy-less. They appear not to understand what it is to communicate emotionally with another person. They appear to be tone-deaf to emotions and to emotional distress in other people. And that's a sad case of development gone awry in those kids.
Thank you very much. It certainly seems to have implications for...
Oh, thank you. Those are wonderful topics.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Let's talk with someone else. This caller is also in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Speaking talking about the universality of facial expressions, I'm wondering about the close visual aspect of say the emotions of ecstasy and pain. I know that some people, when they look at the, if you know the painting of Edvard Munch,
uh-huh.
called The Scream,
uh-huh.
They don't know, you know, if they don't know the title, they're not sure whether that's pain or ecstasy. And do you have any speculations about why these expressions are so closely resemble each other?
Well, one of the interesting things is that emotional communication occurs across a variety of sensory modalities. So part of it's visual, part of it is clearly auditory, part of it is not only facial expression, but changes in facial expression, body language in terms of posture of the limbs, of the trunk, of the head, and so forth.
Yeah.
And also the kind of rhythmic evolution of those changes, which is very difficult to capture in a still image or
time
a photograph. A living person may well transmit a lot more detailed sensory information about his or her emotions than a single still image does.
Right. Yeah.
Emotional expressions, interestingly enough, are not that different from one another. And if you look at the difference in between even emotions that we think of as very different, like anger or sadness, it's a few millimeters difference in the contraction of a couple of muscles here and there in the face.
Well, even the feeling of it, ecstasy and pain are very closely related, I think.
Well, they certainly can be, especially in terms of their intensity, mm-hmm. that they are two particular emotions that people can experience at a level of intensity which can be almost overwhelming.
Right.
And that may be one of the things that registers in the face is the overwhelming intensity level.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. Anywhere, in fact, the signal will travel, and that is 800-222-9455. In the book, in the beginning part of the book, you spend a little bit of time talking about the structure of the brain and about the fact that the brain has different parts and we think of them as older and younger in an evolutionary sense. And it's the older parts of the brain that are responsible for some of the most basic functions, the fact that we continue to breathe, and the fact that we respond certain ways perhaps to danger, that we have drives to feed ourselves, we have drives to reproduce. And it's the more recent parts of the brain that have to do with more higher order functions, things like thinking and language and so forth. Is part of the reason that it's maybe sometimes a little difficult for us to think about love, to talk about love, even to try to figure out what it is. Does that have something to do with the fact that the feelings are in one place and that the words are in another place, and just getting those two places together is sometimes a little difficult?
That's absolutely correct, and it's one of the places where modern neuroscience can provide a satisfying kind of explanation for an experience that human beings have noted for many thousands of years. Because, of course, throughout the recorded history of art and literature and poetry and song, many writers and artists have lamented about how difficult it is to figure out what's going on with our feelings and how hard it is to express them or give them words or give them a comprehensible framework. And the reason is just what you're describing, that feelings and emotions come from brain structures that are about 100 million years old, whereas language and thinking and logic come from brain structures that are at most a million years old, to be generous, and really probably several hundred thousand years old would be more accurate. So there's a tremendous gap of time of about 100 million years between the brain structures that create feeling and emotions and love and bonding and the brain structures that are capable of understanding and logic and language. And so it probably is less surprising even that there are mental experiences in the emotional realm that we cannot understand or make proper logical sense of or put into words very easily. Mm. In that light, that's a place where science can help explain our experience in those areas.
Let's talk with another caller. This is in, the person is in Tuscola, and it's line one.
Morning.
Yes, hello.
I got in on kind of the middle here. I enjoyed hearing about your insight about love and whatever. And is this something that would benefit someone with a dementia, probably, or not? Or am I kind of off base?
Would love benefit someone with a dementia?
Yeah, uh-huh.
It certainly could and does, in fact. And again, because the brain structures that are destroyed in dementia are the ones that are important in thinking and logic and language often, those suffer a terrible loss. But the brain structures that are important in feeling emotions are much less affected, mm-hmm. so that demented people may not be able to think or remember very well, but they can still be quite emotionally responsive. And you often see, of course, that people with a dementia can be rapidly calmed down by the soothing presence of a family member where nothing else can calm them down.
Right, yeah.
They certainly are sensitive to relationships, and some recent data has indicated that in nursing home residents, for instance, some of whom are elderly and have dementia, that relationships continue to regulate their physiology in an important way, that one of the most important determinants of nursing home mortality is how many visitors you have,
mm-hmm.
Which actually turns out to be more important even than how old you are in determining
right.
your mortality. So people with dementia certainly are emotionally responsive and remain sensitive to relationships and to expressions of love.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. I'll continue to listen to you.
All right, thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
I think that's... That's interesting in that, and I suppose some people might be surprised that it would, you know, that the presence of a family member might have that effect on someone with dementia, particularly if the person who is experiencing the dementia seems not to know that that person is their family member. I mean, it could be that as far as they're concerned, they're just another person who would happen to walk in the door. And yet, at some level, they seem to apparently recognize the connection.
That's true, and of course, one of the difficulties is how to assess whether someone with a dementia does recognize somebody else, because the dementia may impair their language function so that they can't say, you know, hello, Fred, or I know it's you, or something like that. But nevertheless, the parts of the brain that retain their function may be capable of registering the presence of that person, and you often find with a person with dementia that one of the most distressing things for them is to be around unfamiliar people, and one of the most calming or soothing things is simply to bring in people whom the person is familiar with. It has a tremendous calming and soothing effect on them.
Hmm. And if indeed there's, you know, it makes you wonder what exactly the nature of the bond is and how this gets communicated, if in fact there can be an effect, even though the individual wouldn't recognize the other person. So that has to mean that there's something going on, some kind of communication going on at some other level, which we don't directly observe.
Or a connection, say, on a level that we might describe as intuitive. Rather than explicit.
Uh-huh.
And again, many of the explicit kinds of cognitive mental functions would be damaged in dementia. But actually, a number of very interesting studies have showed that patients with dementia who are incapable of learning explicit information, so if you come in the room and say, you know, today is February 13th and my name is David, and leave the room and come back 10 minutes later, they don't remember any of those things. That even though they're incapable of that kind of learning, that they are still capable of intuitive learning. That if you expose them to certain emotional situations, they can still retain intuition about them. For instance, in one experiment, a man who had no capacity to remember facts was, because of brain damage, was exposed to three people in succession, one of whom had been instructed to treat him in a nice way, one of whom had been instructed to be neutral with him, and the third one who had been instructed to treat him in a mean way. And later, the three people were brought back into the room, and he was asked if he had ever seen any of them before, and he said no, because he can't learn that kind of information. But they said, well, who would you like to go with to the store? And he picked the nice guy.
Huh.
So that there is emotional information that can still register, even in the absence of some of those more explicit cognitive brain functions.
Let's take another call. This is someone listening in southeastern Illinois, our line four. Hello.
Yeah. Could I ask you to define your term?
To define love?
Yes.
Of course, that's a tall order. That is a that's a tough question. The love, of course, is a multidimensional phenomenon, and so any definition that I'm going to give is clearly going to be inadequate in some respects. But I would say, on an experiential level, love, or the word that we use, is the feeling that you get of being able to sense someone else's needs or their feelings, and feeling the urge to provide or care for or nurture the feelings that you find there. On a biological level, love is the operation of a system that's very old, that's buried deep in our brains, which is meant to enable us to read emotional states in other mammals. It's meant to control and regulate our physiologies, and it binds us together and binds other mammals together also in mutually regulating groups. And so on a biological level, that's what love is.
Can I give you a short all-inclusive definition?
Sure.
Love is an extension of the self.
Well, you know, I think that's one thing that it is.
But,
although,
form of love isn't an extension of oneself?
Well, for instance, I don't know that there's anything in that definition, say, about the biological regulation that science has discovered is at the heart of love or relationship.
That's the plumbing. I mean, that's I'm speaking of it as a psychological term rather than a physiological term, but as a that's why love is painful, is because you if you have a very deep love for someone, you are making them a part of yourself. A part of yourself over which you don't have the control, and
I think that's one reason why love is painful. I think there are others, actually, including, for instance, the fact that your brain is wired to experience intense pain when it's deprived of something it needs to live. For instance, if you take away someone's oxygen or you take away their water, they begin to suffer almost immediately. And when you take away someone's love or their relationships, they also begin to suffer in a very painful way. And one of the reasons for that is if the brain is well designed, the things that we need to live should feel very good when we get them, and they should feel very painful when we don't get them.
Well, maybe you could say that the self is that the psychological self is like the body. It needs nourishment. It needs nutrients. From the outside, I'm going to be cut off here in a little short time, so I want to mention one other thing.
Uh-huh.
Is that I have not been a fan of President Clinton, but I found it difficult to whack the guy because I sympathize with him because his mother at his birth dumped him on her parents and went off to Little Rock for 4 years while she found herself another husband unencumbered by her child.
Uh-huh.
And I think that one of the explanations for the things that he does that seem unexplainable is the fact that the deprivation. And he has talked of his grandfather, but I've never heard him mention his grandmother, so I don't know that she was a satisfactory substitute for his mother. I mean, if she was giving him the love that a mother would, why, that would, that could substitute. But I've never heard him mention her, so I don't think he was that close to her. It doesn't seem to have been.
Well, you're certainly right in a general sense. I myself don't know much specifically about the rearing environment of Mr. Clinton, but we certainly know in a general sense that children who suffer the loss of one parent or both parents, even if it's for not their lifetime, but a period of several years, that can exert very significant psychological and biological effects on children that may have a long-lasting effect on their personality and their later actions. So you may be onto something there.
Well, what do you think about the commonplace idea that even if one has a good relationship with one's parent, particularly one's mother, maybe even if indeed it is a powerful relationship, then somehow for the rest of your life you're trying to recreate that?
Well, I think that's very true. And if in fact the relationship that you have with your mother is substantially loving, it turns out to be a good thing if you spend your life recreating that, because then you can marry someone who's substantially loving, and you can have relationships with your own children that are substantially loving, and it turns out to be a good thing. If the relationship, the pivotal relationship with your mother, has important negative emotional attributes, then those too can echo down the years of your life as you reenact those.
We are a little past the midpoint of this part of Focus, and I'd just like to introduce our guest. We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Lewis. He's assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, also former associate director of the Affective Disorders Program there. He writes, he has a private practice, also teaches at UC San Francisco at the med school, and is one of the authors of a book that explores the territory here we're discussing. If you'd like to read more, you can look for it. It's titled A General Theory of Love. It's published by Vintage in paper, so it's not terribly expensive. You can look for it in the bookstore. And questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller in line is Kankakee, and this is line one. Hello.
Yes, sir. Dr. Lewis there?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I enjoy your commentary here and so forth. I guess I don't know where to start almost, but it's pertaining to love. But all of our friends today that were some sort of war, whatever, and seeing annihilation and so forth, and came home and they were so happy to have a family and everything.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is the next generation was like they turned their head. They didn't continue a relationship as far as their religion. And, of course, how could you expect, be it the boys or girls, when the others went off the same way? And that's why our country's in such a bedlam, I think.
Uh-huh. Well, you know,
I know it sounds ridiculous, but I've also had a friend. He said he just adored this girl, and he told me, he says, you know, he says, main reason I don't want to marry her, he said if we ever broke up, it would just annihilate me. And I know that sounds really strange.
No, actually, a lot of people think that, and I think the difficulty with that is that it's true that there's tremendous pain with putting yourself on the line and getting into an intimate relationship and giving someone your all, in a sense. And if it doesn't work out, or they leave you, or perhaps even if they die and leave you without meaning to, that can be terribly painful. I would have to say, clearly, in my experience, and I think in the experience of my co-authors, Dr. Lannan and Dr. Amini, as painful as that can be, it's much more painful to live the life that you're describing that your friend has in mind, where in order to protect himself from that kind of pain, he's going to remain isolated or alone, which is a guarantee of suffering and pain, whereas the other way is merely a risk of pain.
Well, my main issue was about where our country has gone with the offspring, say, if you were the second generation of from men and women who have been in war, and they realize the sacrifices that everybody put on the line, and the younger ones just kind of sniff their nose at it and, you know, forget about it.
Well, I think a lot of people worry about the weakening of relationship ties in our society, and I think it's generally true that they are weakening, that families are not as strongly together as they used to be, that communities are not as bonded. In some places in the country, it's difficult to find communities at all. You simply find people who are cohabiting in the same geographical region, but there's no emotional connection or no community. I think a lot of people worry, and they're right to worry, that relationship ties appear to be weakening in some fundamental sense. Exactly why that's happening, I'm not sure, although I think it's true that it is happening and that we all ought to be worried about it. because it's going to have deleterious consequences not only for the happiness of people who are relatively isolated, who are going to not be happy, but also for the kind of the health of the nation or the national fabric of our society, I think will be weakened as we see that happen. I'm not quite sure why it's happening. I'd be interested to hear what everybody thinks about it, but I think it is happening.
Mm. Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. Time is slipping away here. We just have about 10, 12 minutes and two other callers, so hope you won't mind if I go on. Let's talk with someone next in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, two questions, and you can shoot at either one or both or neither, I guess.
Okay.
I was wondering if you have any opinion as to, and what I'm thinking about of here is places where marriages are arranged. Do you have any opinion about love before marriage or after? And that's question number one. Is there anything that would indicate one is better than the other? And then number two, I was wondering if you are properly brought up, you know, with and you've been imprinted with the proper well, you know what I'm talking about. Given that you're a normal person,
right?
Still, what are the limits of your ability to reach out and love somebody? Like, is there can you see any kind of chemical reason as to why it'd be difficult to love another race, say, for example?
Those are both fascinating questions. I'm happy to tackle them and see what becomes of it. In terms of the first question about arranged love, you know what? One of my co-authors, Dr. Amini, actually grew up in Persia, in Iran, and at the time he grew up, actually, arranged marriages were pretty much the order of the day. And what he says is that in that society, it was understood that people entered into marriage for various socially important reasons, like to consolidate wealth or that marriage served a social purpose, but that everybody understood that the emotional aspect of falling in love and romantic love would be satisfied outside of the marriage. So that even though marriages were arranged, adultery was quite common, and that people would have love affairs with other people that they'd picked out, even though the society dictated that who they were married to was a different person that had been arranged for them. I think it's actually quite difficult to make love happen or make it flower by decree, just by putting two people together and saying, here, you have to love one another. And that most of the time, that doesn't work out, that the people may share something and it may be important, but it's not necessarily or not easily the same kind of intense emotional bond that happens when people get to be attracted to who they're attracted to and get to pick out their own mate spontaneously.
Yeah.
The second question in terms of if people are properly brought up and they can love well, what are the limits of their ability to reach out to other people, and is there something that makes it difficult for them to love someone from another race? The most healthy kind of love, properly speaking, is mutual, in the sense that that you would love somebody who loves you back if you know how to love well, and that you would not be that interested in somebody who treats you badly. So in terms of the limits of your ability to reach out, if the other person is treating you badly, you might feel like reaching out for a little while, but then pretty soon you'd be uninterested and turned off, and you wouldn't feel like extending yourself, and your attention would turn instead to someone who is willing to treat you well. In terms of the racial question, that actually addresses an issue that is older than love, probably, a little bit older, or a little bit different than love, which is that human beings are essentially tribal animals, in like chimpanzees are, in that they are very prone to congregate in groups that they identify as this is us, and to identify another group as them. And they're very inclined to dislike and attack and even sometimes hate the group that's identified as them, and they're inclined to love the group that's identified as us. You see that commonly, say, in the very vehement and even violent struggles that erupt around sporting teams. You know, the home team is us, and the team from Dallas or the team from Los Angeles is them, and we hate those players, but we love our own players. That's one of the things that happens in race relations, is that innate tendency of people to identify a certain group of people as us and another group as them. And unfortunately, in America, it probably would work best if we all identified kind of the fundamental us level as like Americans, and we could think of each other as Americans first and black people or white people or Asian people second, but that's quite difficult for people to do, and they often don't manage to do that, and they succumb to the more regional level of thinking where they think of people essentially like themselves as being us, and that for many people that turns out to be people of the same race. That's one of the reasons why racism is very difficult to eradicate.
Let's go again to another caller. This is Pena, line 3. Hello.
Hello. I'm a retired teacher of 38 years, and I just wanted to involve our schools in this discussion of love because I think it's very, very important. And I just heard you mention the us and them. We have a lot of groups like that happen in school. I taught grade school most of my years, and I just wonder sometimes if teachers are aware of how important their attitudes and their interests and their love is, and to keep this balance in the classroom and at the school so that everybody gets along and we do have an actual, I guess I could call it love situation.
You know, I think
I know it'll work.
I think your point is a wonderful one, actually. I think teachers get an awfully short shrift in our society in a number of ways in terms of how we regard them. And it certainly is true that that something magical and loving can happen in a classroom where the teacher has the right kind of emotional attitude for the students and that they're tuned in to the teacher. And as children naturally are, they're somewhat, well, actually more than somewhat, they're highly disposed to orient towards influential adults in their immediate area and to believe what the adult says and to take to heart the things that the adult says and does. That mechanism probably was originally designed for parents, but teachers can certainly take advantage of it. I think it's a hugely important emotional communication can occur between teachers and students when it's all going well, and unfortunately, of course, in lots of classrooms in the United States, that has kind of gone by the wayside.
I realize that, yes.
Yeah, and that, you know, I think part of it is class sizes are so much bigger. It's
oh, yes, definitely.
The teachers and students to relate emotionally on that level. I think there, in some schools, there's really just kind of an unfortunate emphasis on rote learning, that you're just supposed to cram the stuff into kids' heads as fast as you can. And I think the human dimension of teaching, which in some ways can be the most influential in terms of motivating students to learn, is sadly neglected, and we probably all ought to...
Well, I think it is. I just wanted to say a few years ago they had introduced what I would call holistic learning, which I believe covers the whole child, the whole person for all of us. And that's gone by the wayside by all of this testing that they have to do now. I think the idea of interest and love has gone by the wayside, at least in our state.
And sadly so, because I think children who are actively engaged with an adult who cares about them and they care about the adult, those are the kids who are the most motivated and the most interested and I think spontaneously energized to learn.
But see what's happened, though, in our state. I still help out at school, at least in grade school, is the teachers are so attuned to this testing they have to do every year, they don't have time to love them.
Absolutely.
You know, that's what I'm saying, and our schools are too big, and I think all this shooting and fighting and stuff and carrying on goes back in some way to this lack of interest and empathy and love.
Well, I think that's definitely true, and in fact, I personally think it's clear that the school shootings that have erupted are principally due to alienation and the emotional frustration of not having something to belong to. In fact, the website material of those kids who shot up the school in Columbine, Colorado, was really a poignant example of that. If you read the material on their website, those kids were plainly describing how agonizing it was for them to be alone and isolated and excluded and not feeling like they could belong to the school or belong to a coherent thing that was larger than themselves, a group that would take them in. And it really was agonizing for them, and at one point they snapped eventually because of that influence.
We're almost out of time, and I just wanted to give you a chance to talk, and unfortunately I'm going to give you about a minute or two, just a little bit more about one aspect of this that I think is really interesting and that you touched on in the first half of the interview, and that is the extent to which our health and well-being in a very literal sense does depend on having close, loving relationships. This bond with the other person does indeed affect us in a physiological way.
In a powerful way, and I'm glad you brought that up because we haven't addressed it so much. What neuroscience has discovered is that people are fundamentally designed to require emotional contact with other people, and that it tunes their physiology to function at an optimum level. And when people get that, they're healthier in a variety of ways. When they don't get that, they fall ill in a variety of ways. And there's an enormous amount of medical data now that tracks how very much more common heart disease, cancer, ulcers, all kinds of illness are in socially isolated people. And that even though we don't think about it, relationships with other people are more influential on our physical health than the factors that we're used to thinking about, like diet or exercise or the amount of cholesterol and so forth. And that if we actually wanted to make ourselves healthy physically, forget about emotionally, but we just wanted to enhance physical health, the single best thing we could do for ourselves would be to make sure that we had close emotional ties to other people.
Well, I certainly wish we could continue. There are more that we could do, and there's more in the book, but we'll just have to stop because we're at the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading more on the subject, I will suggest you look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled A General Theory of Love, published by Vintage in paper. One of the three authors, our guest this morning, Thomas Lewis, he's a assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. Dr. Lewis, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.